And good morning. It's 10 o'clock this Wednesday morning. You are tuned to KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna, and it is time once again for the Kenai Conversation. I'm your host, Shaylin Cochran, and thank you so much for joining us this morning. And we've got a lot of big things to talk about this morning. We're going to be focused a lot on the state legislature and various goings-on that have happened recently and what's coming up here actually tomorrow. And joined in the studio this morning with Representative Gary Knopp. Gary, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And so just to get it started here, of course, we'll give out the numbers. If you have some questions for Representative Knopp, would like to get in on the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. 690-1687 is the number. Again, 690-1687 if you would like to get in on the conversation. And I guess, Gary, just to get started this morning, actually, you'll be leaving and heading back to Juneau tomorrow. What's going on there? We got a little another special session coming up.
It's gonna be a one-day special session, just gonna convene, take it to the floor, the capital budget, and SB 23, I believe, is what we're looking at, and hopefully pass it out by the end of the day and back home tomorrow night.
And what are we looking at with that stuff? I know that that's something that is maybe a little bit in the air. We haven't seen necessarily everything that's going to be debated and voted on for the special session.
No, we haven't. It's, ultimately the capital budget, we had I think SB 23 was in front of us, and now we have a conference committee, and we have a chair of Senate Finance and a chair of House Finance negotiating the final terms of that, and we have not been privy to the final conversations and what the compromise language is. We will see that when it gets to the floor tomorrow. I mean, we do have the bill. I think it's just fine-tuning it, that the compromise language shouldn't be substantially different than what we have in the bill.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wondered if you had any concerns or things that you were worried about that might have changed since, you know, this was last reviewed and now it's coming up for sort of final approval.
You know, I'll just tell you the two big ticket items in the capital budget bill was $800 million that was put in by the House to fully fund permanent fund dividends this year, and I understand that language has been removed. That's what I'm hearing. I haven't read it, but that's what I'm hearing. And the other thing, in the Senate version of the capital budget, there was $228 million to pay some of the debt that we owe to industry. And I also understand that has been removed as well. So that would probably be the two biggest ticket items. But again, I don't know everything in that compromise language.
Yeah, and those two things that you mentioned, those were sticking points and talking points all throughout the legislative session about how do we handle oil subsidies, how generous ought we to be, how much should we expect from the industry, and then the PFD conversations. And I guess just to kind of back it up a little bit, this was your first term in the House of Representatives, and you really jumped into a good one, I guess. But what are your thoughts? As you said, there's no such thing as a perfect bill, and everything's kind of a compromise. But give us your thoughts about how things have turned out and kind of where we're looking moving forward.
You know, first I'll just say that it's a little odd to sit here as a representative. I'm used to being called a candidate when I'm sitting in this chair. So it's nice. So we got to Juneau, and of course we ran on the Republican ticket. We've held control, majority control down there for 18 years. And I guess I thought that was going to continue. We didn't plan on being a minority, but that's where we ended up. And so there's a lot of things that I had planned to do that I was unable to do. And so we just shifted our focus and tried to work the other issues. You know, I'm more about an issue guy. I'm not about the partisan politics. And so I found common ground on both sides of the aisle. So I've spent a lot of this session relationship building, trying to support good bills and defeat bad bills, and that's what we've done. But I think ultimately everybody says, how's the session? You know, there's a lot of frustration in it, but at the end of the day, I'm really happy with what my office has done, how we've progressed in our relationships, getting along with both sides of the aisle and the issues we've supported. So
this is a great opportunity as you bring up some of the work that you've done in your office. You've got a couple of things that I looked into, House Bill 182, and that's dealing with state finances and kind of chipping away a little bit at how can we save a few bucks here, a few bucks there. Do you want to just talk a little bit about HB 182 and what that does in terms of compensation for state employees?
I'll say I wish I could take all the credit for HB 182 because it's a great bill. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to move it, and I can't really take the credit for it because my chief of staff was a former director of labor relations and personnel, and also a labor commissioner at one point, and a very intelligent, experienced lady. And she brought it to my attention. That was something we did, I'm going to say back in 2007, we changed the state pay structure because we were having a hard time retaining a certain class of employees. So we changed the pay structure, and what we found out, we kind of open-ended it. It's what we did on the scale without going into really a lot of detail. But in a nutshell, we found out that changing that pay structure did very little for retention in the categories that we needed to retain. And so it ended up costing us about $20 million a year extra. And so in that period of 2007 to 16, we spent a little over $200 million in excess of what we normally would. And so we wanted to put that back the way we've had since statehood, almost, it did not cost any jobs. It didn't cost anybody any money. It did freeze people above a certain pay range. We have some people who are making as much as directors and more, you know, and it's something that needed to be fixed. But it was unable to move the bill this session, but it's still on the books, and we're going to move it in the future when we can. It's something that needs to happen.
Again, tune to the KDLL the Kenai Conversation here on KDLL. Representative Gary Knopp joining us in the studio this morning. And another piece of legislation that I know that you were working on is House Resolution 5, and that was kind of taking into consideration the per diems for legislators during special sessions. Was that right?
Yeah, it is a bill. You know, we let emotions run amok on the floor of the House there, and we had a proposal to slash per diems, and then somebody else made a proposal just completely eliminate them, and it took us down to, I think it finally ended up at $60 a day in per diem, and we knew that wasn't going to fly. So what I did was just tried to pass a resolution for the House. The Senate separated themselves. They just set their own, and we were kind of floundering on what was appropriate. And, you know, the federal government sets the per diem rates twice a year, and they do, and when you look into what the work that they do around the state and setting per diem rates and the studies that's done and the group of people that's done, there's no other way that you can do it as comprehensive as they do. And so, but we didn't necessarily follow it. They have a short-term rate, a 30-day rate, and then they have an interim, like a 6-month, which reduces the rate, and then they have 6 months is even extended rate. So my resolution was let's pay the full per diem rate for 30 days, and let's go to 75% after the 30 days, as was designed. My train of thought was, when you first move to Juneau, everything's in disarray, you're not unpacked, you haven't got your living accommodation settled yet, and there are some extra expenses. So let's do the full rate for 30 days, and then by then, in 30 days, you're settled down, you're established, you got things under control, and 75% rate was adequate. During the winter season, now keep in mind, in the spring, they changed that. This last trip to Juneau, my per diem rate did not cover my hotel room and car rental for one day. So it is quite a disparity in that. So,
is that one of those things that, you know, we hear a lot of times about when benefits are afforded to folks, if you start to think about trying to rein in costs and cut costs and remove some of those benefits, is that the same kind of conversation for legislators? Like, why would you take away my per diem? And in the case that you pointed out to, it doesn't always cover the day.
It does in the winter months. You can cover it, you know, but, you know, everybody's circumstances are different. You know, for me, I can get a small room in a hotel down there and walk and get by just fine, and that's what I did this session. But other people bring their families. They have wives and kids, and they enroll them in school. So they need a larger place, and circumstances change. And I can tell you, houses in Juneau are not cheap. Even a hotel room in Juneau is not cheap in the winter, you know. And then come April 1, we don't have rooms. They don't book us long term after that, and then you're hotel jumping. You get a night here, night there, bed and breakfast here, a couple nights in the office. So it's whatever you can find at that point.
Yeah, and before we jump off into that whole other conversation of why is the Capitol in Juneau again?
Yeah.
We'll remind the callers 690-1687. Again, 690-1687 is the number if you'd like to get in on the conversation, joined with Gary Knopp, Representative Gary Knopp, this morning. And speaking on the budget, and that's, you mentioned going back to a one-day, hopefully just a one-day special session to approve a capital budget. But some big questions. Some questions were sort of answered. Plenty of questions addressed during the legislative session. I guess a little bit ago you talked about the House Majority Coalition. I guess I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. How did that work, or do you think that you're not a member of the House Majority Coalition? Do you think did that help get something done, or was that kind of a thorn in the side and just sort of was a roadblock for finding some common ground?
The answer is no and no. It's not a roadblock. It didn't get nothing done. It's not any more efficient. They had an idea, you know, the problem with it, and they're good people, don't get me wrong, you know, but it didn't work. They didn't function as well as they needed to, or as they should have. Just say that plainly, bluntly. It just, you know, the system is what they know. It's been in place for 20 years. So if it wasn't working then, all you did was just change the roles, but the system is the same. That's what needs to be fixed. The problem is they like to play too much partisan politics, and everybody's trying to outthink everybody else, and one body's trying to outthink the other body. Instead of taking a piece of legislation that's good or bad, move it up or down on its merits, but they want to hold it hostage in return for something else, and it just doesn't work. It's just not a good system. And so, the coalition changing, it's just not working.
Do you feel like that's happening just within the House chamber? Because I feel like that's happening sort of between both chambers of the legislature, that, you know, you have bills that address largely the same things and they look completely different between the House and the Senate. So is that an issue too, is bridging the gap between the two chambers?
Well, it is, but, you know, you have to start off with a good faith. I mean, you don't take a bill that's not bad and bring it over and say, well, yeah, we'll pass it, but we need these things. This is our concessions, you know. Well, it's obviously that's not going to happen. You know, the problem is going into the start of the session, everybody knew what the other bodies and individuals were asking. But instead of starting there, what you knew was going to be asked, you wait until the end of session and special session to even start talking about what you knew you need to start talking about in January. And it's almost like special sessions and conference committees are an acceptable norm. You know, to me, they should be the exceptions, and we've just gotten into that practice.
Yeah, they're not particularly special anymore.
It's the not-so-special sessions. That's what we're calling them nowadays.
Yeah, that's right. Well, but there is a lot of serious debate left to go on with these, and I guess we'll get into some of those bigger questions. And what we keep hearing, you know, when folks come back and when we hear about the budget discussion here locally, it's really boiled down to some pretty basic ideas. We can continue to cut. We can find new revenues in the form of sales tax, income tax, or we can start monkeying around with the permanent fund. And what do you think about this stuff?
You know, I think that probably the operating budget is probably the most contentious, philosophically contentious. You know, the Republicans, the conservatives think there needs to be some more cutting. Those who are less conservative thinks that we've cut just as little as we can. For those of us in the middle, we think unless you dive into the details of how we do our business and what we're truly, it's a detail thing, and you don't get that opportunity to dive into that, so you don't really know if it's as lean as it's going to get, if there's a lot more to cut. Everybody has an opinion on that. And so for me, that was a struggle, so I don't think that we do very well at looking into the details of how we conduct our business, and only when you do that can you really tell if this is as lean as we can possibly get. The other thing that throws a monkey wrench in the system is all the federal dollars that come in. If you cut any state dollars out, you're starting to affect federal dollars. When you do that, you're affecting jobs and incomes and services. I mean, there's a lot of things. It's a trickle-down effect that is part of the conversation. So it is not an easy process. But having said that, when you talked about the oil and gas tax bill, or even the capital budget, them things were not as contentious. We weren't as far apart on them items as people were led to believe. They were not that contentious. But let's take an item in the capital budget, for example, permanent fund dividends. Mm-hmm. People are adamant. They want their dividends as they were promised. The Senate wanted to pay off a debt that we are statutorily obligated to pay, and that's oil and gas tax debt to cash flow credits, you know, which is going to push $1 billion this year, but it's under $1 billion yet, but it's $800 million, somewhere in that number. So we need to pay that debt. It has to happen. But the timing is bad. You don't get to take away people's permanent fund checks this year and give industry $220 million. At some point in time, we'll have to do that. We just need to figure out how to do that. It's a debt that has to be paid. If revenues come back, you know, maybe that's the time to do it. But there's a statutory requirement to pay a minimum amount of that. And I think that is some of the philosophical differences that you get into there, you know, what's the lesser of all the evils. So,
yeah, that's absolutely what it is. And that's, you know, that's why these debates have been drawn out for months and months and months and years, I guess, really. Yeah. We're getting to that point as well. Tune to the Kenai Conversation here on KDLL. We're joined with Representative Gary Knopp talking all things about the state budget. Lots to talk about there, and we'd love to hear from you as well if you want to get in on the conversation. 690-1687 is the number. Again, 690-1687 if you would like to get in on the conversation this morning. And so kind of getting back to those sorts of big areas, you mentioned that there wasn't a lot of some of that stuff. You mentioned that, you know, folks were pretty close together on, you know, they were kind of coming from the same place and had the same kind of end goal in mind, and, you know, getting from A to B, there was some discussion, but the path was laid out. And talking about about cutting the budget, is that an area where you felt like there was a lot of folks starting from the same point, or is that an area where there's definitely lines in the sand and some folks said, that's it, we've cut enough, and other folks, well, let's take some time and dig into this? And which camp would you consider yourself in?
I'm in the middle ground. I need to understand the details of how we do our business. Should we continue to do it and we don't have revenue to support it, you know? That's the camp I'm in. I've said, you know, it's all part of the conversation. But, yeah, there were lines drawn in the sand. The new coalition felt, adamantly felt, that there was no more room to cut. We've cut all we can cut. And those on the conservative side, you know, there's a lot of places we can cut yet. And I got to tell you that it does rub me a little bit raw when we go back and we say, well, since 2007, 8, 9, whatever, typical a year, when we've had revenue, $100 barrel oil, we've had more revenue we've ever seen in the state coming in, and we're down 40% from the state. Well, why do you pick that date? Because it's the highest number you got. It's ludicrous to do that. Let's just go a couple more years back when we had an ordinary year, a normal income, ordinary budgets, and let's see where we are in comparison adjusted for inflation. But we didn't do that. We took these years that were pretty flat, and then we got a big spike in income, and we spent like drunk sailors. And then that's the years we want to use as reference for cutting, and that's not right either, you know. So
right, and as you say, it's interesting because it's not as if this is a new phenomenon. The idea that oil prices go down and budgets within the state have to respond to that, and it's tough. That's not necessarily a new phenomenon in Alaska. Yeah,
it is not. It is not. And, you know, and prior legislators got beat up for not doing enough and spending too much. But, you know, the reality of it is, we saved, we before we started spending savings, we had about $18 billion in the earnings reserve account. We had another $15 billion in the CBR. So we saved a lot of money. We had a lot of money saved just for this day, you know. If you hadn't spent money on capital budgets and helping communities at their request, you would have got beat up for that too. So I think they did a great job. I'll be honest with you. I think they did. I think if they failed at all, I would have preferred to see more inflation proofing and more money put into the corpus of the permanent fund. If you could have grown that permanent fund quicker to, say, $100 billion mark, and then had to draw 3% on it, we probably wouldn't be having the same conversations today.
Yeah.
But that's hindsight at this point. Had I been there, I probably would have done the same thing that had been done. So I don't fault them. I thought they did a pretty good job. They saved a lot of money. I think going forward, you know, you don't know when revenue will rebound. You can't continue to spend savings down to nothing. So you have to act somewhere. And that act is whether it's a source of revenue or some more cuts.
And I think I get the impression that you would like to find out more about where efficiencies could be found if there's still room for it. But at the same time, if we've tapped out, we've tapped out, and it's time to look at other things, right?
Well, that's exactly right. But, you know, for me, I like to dig into the details of a lot of our social programs. And don't get me wrong, that's really what we have is social programs of every magnitude all over the state, you know. And so let me give you an example. There was a proposal to cut all funding for public radio and
sure.
broadcasting. And had been setting through that a little bit over the years on the assembly and other conversations, you know. I know that the number's not large, And if you divvy it up amongst all the public broadcasts, it's not a lot of money to each individual organization. And if you look at how remote the state is, in a lot of places in the state, that's the only avenue they have for media. So I was not a supporter of cutting funding for public radio. It did very little. So that's the type of detail stuff that I want to know, no matter where it is.
And so. We certainly appreciate that. We certainly appreciate that support. But you get to an interesting idea because in one area of the state, it can be argued that this resource that is invested in statewide, maybe in Kenai or Anchorage, that resource isn't used as much or depended on as much, but it's still there. And out in the bush, it's very much depended on. And that's not just public radio. That's all sorts of different services. And so that's where the scalpel comes out, and you really have to be careful.
That's exactly right. You know, so yeah, the state is so diverse and the needs are so different from every region. You know, it's a hard balance to make a good fit.
Is that something that you were surprised by a little bit or learned a little bit more in terms of just how diverse those needs are and some of the different angles that folks are coming at when they're advocating for this, that, or the other thing at the legislative level?
No, not for me particularly, and I think I contribute that to my time with the Alaska Municipal League Board when I sit on the board of directors, because that board is made up of elected officials from all over the state. And at that level, when I was on the assembly, is when I figured out how diverse and how our needs are. So I was pretty acutely aware of the differences because of that experience, I think. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, joined with Representative Gary Knopf this morning on the Kenai Conversation. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, give us a call, 690-1687. Again, 690-1687. And kind of sticking with the budget and again, these big ideas that have been thrown around as to how to get us through where we're at and, you know, multi-billion dollar deficits and spending down savings. You know, the permanent fund dividend is front and center of that conversation, as probably it should be. That's the thing that Alaska is so unique to Alaska, and a portion of why it exists is for events such as this. And so, but how we apply it to an event such as this is kind of where the rubber meets the road. And I'll just kind of open it up. How would you characterize the debate on this so far?
It's an interesting debate, and of course, you know, we have the Bill Wilikowski lawsuit in front of the Supreme Court waiting on a ruling for that. There's a lot of constitutionalists, a lot of law people reading statute all the time, and they have a different interpretation depending on. So, but it's interesting if you go back to Governor Hammond's, you know, he created the permanent fund, then they created the permanent fund dividend, and the purpose of that was, in fact, I don't know if his intent was so much to have the payout for the dividend to the people or is to have the people invested in the permanent fund in itself. And you can see the dividend has got people invested in the permanent fund. And I think that was his intent, to keep the public involved, because he knew what politicians would do over time when the need arose. So I understand that component of it, and it somewhat makes sense. But on the other hand, to use permanent fund earnings to help fund government, a reasonable level of government, not an exaggerated level, and that's where we have to get to. But some people don't want to give up anything. So for me, every day that I don't have to pay a state income tax or a statewide sales tax is a permanent fund day. You know, I'm okay with that. I really truly am. But I understand that people who count on that, with large families who count on that extra every year, and the impacts it has, business people who count on it for the economy, individuals who count it for a few perks or just to pay the bills. I understand that importance. So it's a tough, tough issue. It really is. And again, trying to find that balance. I think when we get the ruling on the lawsuit, I think it's going to help a lot change directions, whatever that may be.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to that.
Do you have an idea of which way you'd like that to fall, of it staying at a higher amount or having it be capped?
No, you know, I don't have a preference. I can see advantages and disadvantages to both, but I can tell you that it bothers me a little bit when people start acting like it's an entitlement, you know. And so what do you do when you get used to for example, the media recently reported that the permanent fund's up to $60 billion in value, but they don't talk about how some of that is unrealized gains. We've talked about that a lot in the session. So in real estate holdings and things you haven't captured, so I think actual cash value, when I looked at it earlier in the summer, was only like $45 billion, $47 billion in true value, you know. So if markets crashed, if real estate crashed, that would be the true value. So we don't talk about the realized and unrealized gains in that corpus amount. Of course, the stock market's having a banner year, but we've seen that in the tech stock boom years ago. That didn't last forever, and I know a lot of people still working because of that.
That's right. It's interesting because I guess depending on this, on how this court case comes out, that leads to just a different series of questions. All right, so now the court case is settled and we can go with the higher amount, and that's fine. That's a different set of questions than, okay, there's a cap now on the permanent fund dividend, and that leads in a different set of questions.
Well, I think the question will be answered is if the governor had the authority to veto that, you know, in the power of appropriation, and then the permanent fund corp under what, Title 34, is supposed to transfer them earnings to a, you know, and some people say that's all that was needed, you know, and of course then the question of the power of appropriation is left to the legislature. So them are the types of questions that will finally get ironed out and give us clear direction.
Yeah.
Not that at that point that something won't change in statute, but I mean, at least it's gonna define some stuff for us.
Joined this morning on the Kenai Conversation with Representative Gary Canop. We've been talking a lot about the budget and the upcoming special session that's going to be gaveling in Juneau tomorrow. But as we get down to the bottom of the hour, we're going to grab a little break here. It's time for me to grab a little bit more coffee, and we hope that you will stay with us. Again, if you'd like to jump into the conversation coming up for the second half of the show, 690-1687. Again, 690-1687. If you would like to get in on this morning's conversation, we're going to take a quick break. Stick with us. Well, welcome back to the Kenai Conversation here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Thanks so much for sticking with us. I'm your host, Shaylin Cochran, joined this morning with Representative Gary Canop, and we've been spending a good chunk of the morning, and I believe we will continue to spend a chunk of the morning talking about the budget. You know, the state of Alaska facing some interesting fiscal challenges, and we were kind of talking a little bit over the break, Gary, this idea that, you know, there's a ton of money in the permanent fund. The state is only facing a budget gap of a few billion dollars. Why not just pay for it all out of that? That's not quite how it works.
No, it's not. You know, Shaylin, we don't touch the corpus, the principal amount of the permanent fund. We do not touch. It's we haven't even been inflation proofing it. We should be. Part of the earnings go back into that for investment. Its growth is based on its investment returns. And then the earnings are some going to the earnings reserve account, some in the constitutional budget reserve account. Both of them accounts, one of them is drawn because of the investment scenarios that they're in. One of them makes 10, 12% annually, I think, right now. And the other one's probably making 2 or 3% annually. So one of them is used as the one that we tap to pay for government operations, and the other one is just a place to store the unused earnings.
Yeah, it's not as easy as everyone would like it to be. And another thing that we were kind of talking about is the idea that it's become really tough to get anything done sort of across party lines, and you've seen that with this House Majority Coalition trying to be some sort of face of bipartisanship, but I guess the sense that I get is that you feel like that didn't really work out quite the way it was intended.
No, it didn't work out as it was intended. I mean, I had conversations with a lot of the coalition members during the campaign, and that's what their intent was, but it didn't work out that way, you know. So, and it may, you know, being a freshman, maybe that's the way it has to be. It's not the way I like it. They wanted the caucus. They won't bring a bill to the floor unless the entire caucus approves it. They've got support in a 22-member caucus. You have to have 21 members supporting it. Well, it's hard to do that. And so they end up voting on things they don't truly believe in, but because they're supporting the caucus, that's what they do. There's a lot of bills that had support from our side of the aisle, but you know, I'd rather see them, bring them to the floor, debate them, move them up or down based on the merits of the bill, not along party lines.
Are there other things that you can point to, some specific measures that just didn't get that shot that you know were probably pretty darn close, but because they didn't hit that sort of magic threshold, whatever that means, they didn't get a hearing, so to speak?
I'm trying to think. I mean, there are a lot of things, you know. Okay. Pretty much that the caucus says, you know, they agreed to support themselves. I mean, the two rules are in the caucus is you support the operating budget and you support the ruling of the chair as a member of the caucus. That's the kind of the two written rules. Everything else is somewhat unwritten. But, our minority caucus this year, we were unable to move an amendment, to move any bills. It was an automatic no vote on everything we tried to move. They just didn't want to hear it. I guess they viewed us as obstructionist, you know. So we didn't all work together like we should have. It wasn't a true 40-member participation. It was a 22-member. I mean, the reality was that's just how it works. That's just and I want to be very clear. That's how it worked in the past as well. Okay, so I'm not pointing any fingers of blame at the coalition, but they're doing what's always been done because that's what they know, and that's what has to change in this thing to get it more functional. You don't always have to have caucus. If it's a good bill, bring it to the floor. Let both sides of the aisle vote on it.
Is this a message that you're trying to get out among your colleagues? Are you kind of crusading this a little bit?
You know, I do that. I do that when I'm in Juneau, every single chance I get. When we go to a caucus meeting, we want to start beating up on the coalition. I say, hey, we got anything else to talk about? Because if not, I got other things to go do. You know, I'm not going to sit there and participate in that bashing. I just don't need it. That's not what I do. I don't like it. I'm not much into media. I don't have to have my face in the limelight. That's not what I like to do. And so, that's the message I'd like to get out. If it's a good bill, let's move it on its merits. You know, let's don't take a bill from another body, insert language in it that we want, and you know we'll never fly, even if it's a good bill, and then send it back, because that doesn't show any true sense of trust, faith in the other body, you know, and that when you've done that, you just offended them, and now the battle's on. Another good example is the HB 111 oil and gas tax credit. We knew everybody, both parties, administration, agreed that the cash flow credits need to go away. It was killing us. It absolutely had to happen. And some people voted against that bill on philosophical differences. You know, the risk of that is you continue that debt. You know, as we mentioned earlier, there are no perfect bills, you know, so you choose the lesser of the evils if you can support it. And we did. That one had to happen.
I'm really glad you brought that up. That was something that was definitely a bill that I wanted to bring up. That was, you know, one of the major pieces of legislation that was debated and acted upon during this past session. Is this idea of sort of in broad terms, you know, what do we think as a state of how we do business with the oil companies and how much should we be trying to encourage new development and given the low oil price, how much should that be adjusted? And it's a huge, huge question. And as you pointed out, so a lot of that comes down to philosophical differences. And I guess did you sense that there was maybe a bit too much philosophical differences and not enough just digging into the numbers? And here's what's what, fellas.
Yeah. Well, I everybody dug into the numbers and they realized that sure. Cash flow credit thing. You know, and in past legislators, they did that. Revenue was fat, and the three majors, there was a lot of small development cooking that kind of spurred that when we had the brownouts, no gas, and we needed some smaller companies to come in and look for some gas, and it worked. It worked. We got investments. We got gas. No shortage now. We've had a lot of things happen, but we paid a lot of money at the state level to make that happen. If you actually look at the rates of return on them dollars spent, I'm not so sure it was a good business decision. But now revenues are down. We can no longer afford that program. It needed to stop. The other thing that happened is that we actually brought some companies into the state who were undercapitalized. They didn't have the capital they needed to do business here. And we were subsidizing them. And we still have some companies who drill and drill and drill, never produce nothing, and we continue to subsidize. And that's all ended now at the passage at 111. It need to happen. And so we're glad to have some of the smaller companies. Some of them have done really well for us, been really successful. But at some point in time, they have to stand on their own merits there, you know, and the subsidies have to end.
Yeah, very good. Representative Gary Knopp joining us this morning on the Kenai Conversation here on KDLL. If you would like to join us on the conversation, 690-1687. Again, 690-1687. And Representative Knopp, that leads to a sort of a bigger question, at least to me. And this is something that spoke with a couple of weeks back on the show. We had Tim Dillon. He's the manager of the Kenai Peninsula Economic Development District out here. And also Stephanie Queen is the city planner and economic development person in the city of Soldotna. And one of the things that we were talking about is this idea that as a state, you know, 90% of the budget comes from this one industry. And how sustainable is that? What can be done to sort of diversify that and start to rely on other things so that when things aren't going so well, you have more questions to ask and you have more avenues to find solutions as opposed to it's all or nothing with this one thing. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, obviously it's not totally sustainable, but how do we kind of move from here to down the road when we know that we can't depend on 90% of our budget coming from this one industry? That's a big question.
You know, it's tough. Diversification in economies is tough. And you look at what we have to offer. You know, we are challenged geographically. Depend on where our market is, what we're willing to move, where we're willing to sell it. Let me talk about the LNG project, for example, if it was to go. The two biggest things we have going for us there is we're only 7 to 10 days from the Asian markets by ship, depending if it's going to Japan, Korea, China, you know, from Alaska. It's a great shipping route. That's the biggest thing we got going for us. The second biggest thing we have going is we have generations worth of gas, not just a few years, 10 years, generations worth of gas. Our disadvantage is the cost of getting it to market, you know. So that's the challenges we're facing there. But, for example, for the LNG export facilities on the Gulf Coast who happen to run through the canal, they're 3 weeks away. If you miss your queue going through the canal, you go to the back of the line. You don't get the next available slot. You go clear the back of the line. That can set you back another 10 days. But diversify economies is take a look at what we have. We got mining, we got tourism, fishing, hunting, you know, I mean, we do a lot of that. But it's in-state. We're not marketing. We need to bring some dollars into the state from outside. Do we manufacture anything, you know? We have got some small businesses who do some manufacturing on the peninsula. We have some that are kind of under the radar that do employ a lot of people and do things all over the world. I'm not mentioning any names, but we have some local guys who are very innovative. And I think we just need more of that. And I've had them conversations with Mr. Dillon about working groups and innovation, I think, is the sense. But even if we target what we know, and that's our tourism, our fishing, our hunting, our mining, and our mineral resource development is the big thing. And as you know, in the conversations, that's pretty controversial when you get into developing any mining or oil and gas.
Very much so, because it's as everything else, it becomes this question of balance, because you don't throttle back. You don't go from having such a big portion of your budget coming from this one thing to next to nothing overnight. Yeah. There's a transition period. And in something like this, that's not a short transition period.
No, it's not. And, you know, and I don't think that developing any of the other natural resources that we have other than oil and gas, when you look at the volumes and the quantities, that we can possibly make that up in revenue, them types of quantities over all these years. You know, what's Prudhoe Bay celebrating? Swanson River just celebrated 60 years. I think the Taps are celebrating 40 years. So, you know, we're at a transition phase in our history. We really are.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, because certainly a lot of history happening right now in Juneau and elsewhere. Again, tune to the Kenai Conversation this morning. 690-1687 is the number if you'd like to get in on the conversation. Representative Knopp, you mentioned the Alaska LNG project, and that's one that we've seen, again, as the gas market is not showing itself to be particularly favorable at the moment for big time investments in a place like this. One thing that we have seen is that project is kind of getting split up a little bit. And is that a project that you still believe in? Is that something the state ought to still be investing a lot of money in, or should the state be looking for some more partners to take on a bigger share of continuing that project in whatever form it might be?
You know, I'm not ready to rule the project dead. We got people working on it. They're looking for markets. They're looking for financing. They're looking at cost. You know, do we build all three trains now, later? Like I said, we had generations, we got a shorter shipping route, and we have political stability in our country and in our state. We really do, believe it or not. People don't think that in the legislature, but there really is political stability here. So I'm going to support the project, pursuing the project, until people who are pursuing it just tell me they're just not viable, not feasible. And we've talked when the big three pulled out of the project because their rates of return had to have more than what we necessarily have to have, you know. So I'm still optimistic. I don't know all the details of that, you know. The world's evolving. We know that China, India, Japan, Korea, they're all looking for cleaner. China right now is trying to get rid of all their coal-fired stuff, get to more LNGs, cleaner. And that's always nice to hear and see. And they're looking long-term. So the problem is if we don't build it now, at some point, it'll never be cheaper in the future. I mean, it's never going to get any cheaper. I mean, demands may go up and the prices may go up and it might make it more viable. There is, I see today that Malaysia had a firm who was sponsoring a Pacific Northwest, I think in British Columbia, in Canada somewhere, and they scrapped that project, $27 billion. It just wasn't viable, but for the Canadian project. So a lot of gas on the markets right now, but we're not talking tomorrow. We're not talking 5 years. We're talking 20, 30, 40 years on out. So,
And that makes it a difficult conversation to have, too, when you're trying to finance, you know, for the promise that far down the line, it'll pay off.
Well, it's a promise, but you have to, you know, you're talking about countries, you know, supply and energy needs of countries who are looking for generations to come. And so I guess, way after we're gone, they'll still be looking how to support their countries. And so, you know, it's not a short-term plan. It's a very long-range plan. But for me, I can tell you that even if the LNG project export facility did not materialize, I'm still a big advocate for an in-state gas line. I think if we built an in-state gas line, 30-inch, 40-inch, to Cook Inlet, and we serviced Mat-Su, Anchorage, wherever, Yukon Delta, there's been talks about liquefying it and sending it up to rivers, converting our remote rural bush communities to LNGs, cleaner transport. You have incidents, you don't have diesel run down your rivers. It makes a lot of sense, and I think it's truly one of them cases, if you build it, industry will come. I mean, the fertilizer plant used to be here when gas prices wasn't an issue. 3M, they use a lot of natural gas in their projects, Dow Chemical. You know, there's just a lot of things. And their markets are worldwide. They're just not the continental U.S. So, and if you did nothing else other than support your communities with some cheaper energy, it may not be a return on dollar, but you're sure helping your communities an awful lot. So
that's an interesting conversation because, I mean, cheaper energy is something every community wants all over the state, regardless of what your energy situation is now. But that, Trent, you know, again, you know, you might share this sort of jumping off point with your colleagues in the legislature, but getting from and even share the end goal, but getting from A to B, that's the politics, that's the tough conversation. Even on something that on its face makes a ton of sense. We've got tons of natural gas here. You've got money that you could invest in something like that to help communities out, but and it's a really that's a heavy but and it's tough, right?
It is, but, you know, I tell you what, if you run natural gas to Fairbanks, we do so much for Fairbanks. I mean, look at, even now they're battling the EPA over the wood smoke issues, wood burning stoves. They do export some gas up there now, you know, mostly diesel fuels. I can't imagine what it costs them folks to live up there. So, you know, I think anything we can do to get more affordable gas is a better deal for us. So.
It's a good move. All right. And we've got not a ton of time left, but a little bit earlier you mentioned the idea of, and especially as it pertains to Alaska producing goods on a global market, we've got a lot of stability here. And that's something that when you're talking about big time projects over the course of decades, that's what you want is a lot of stability, sure. A lot of predictability. To bring it back a little bit closer to home, you mentioned also that it doesn't always seem like maybe there's a ton of stability in the legislature, and I'm curious, you know, are we getting to a point where the politics just by virtue of the fact that you can't play politics forever. At some point, decisions have to be made. Are we getting there finally, or are we, you know, how much farther do you see cans being kicked down the road, as it were? I mean, some progress was made this legislative session. I don't want to sound like nothing was done and everybody sat on their hands and pouted in the corner. It wasn't quite like that. But at the same time, you know, everybody thinks that more could have been done. So if everybody feels that more could have been done, how do you work together to get that? And are you hopeful that that can eventually happen?
You know, if I'm not going to be a career politician. I'm not going to be the favorite. I'd like to do two, maybe three terms, you know, and then I'll serve my time and somebody else can come in and replace me. But if I have done nothing else in Juneau, I'd like to see us change our process of how we conduct our business. You know, I'd like to see more people interested in the state's business. I'd like to see less people playing partisan politics, less politicians interested in the media. Let's go down there for the issues, get them done, and get out of there. We can always have philosophical differences, you know. I mean, that's you know, just acknowledge the fact there's no perfect legislation. What's done today can be undone tomorrow, and usually is at some point in the future. Things change all the time, but it's interesting enough, as we mentioned earlier, we're in a transition phase in our state's history. You know, the boom days of the oil industry are waning, and it's getting more expensive to do business, and the fines aren't, you know, the Prudhoe Bays. I don't know if there's any more of them up there. We need to keep looking for them, develop them. The infrastructure's there, you know, if we can find them and get them into market. You know, I mean, if you think back when we didn't have the infrastructure, just to get it in place was an enormous event. And so now we have that, we just need to keep utilizing that asset. So.
Yeah, and take advantage of sort of what's here. And again, we've mentioned it several times throughout the program. It's this idea that people are kind of jumping off from the same point. They kind of know that they want to get to the same point, but somehow getting there together has proven very difficult, especially for some reason this legislative session, which, as you've mentioned, not necessarily different from past sessions, just it seems magnified this time around.
Yeah, it is. It's magnified. It's you know, I mean, being freshmen and being the new minority was the old majority. But when you talk to staff people and you talk to lobbyists who've been around Juneau for 40 years plus, and they said, you know, and they tell me, and I asked them, people who've been there a long time, we know that legislative sessions always have a level of dysfunction. And they said, yes, that's true. But they think it's a little worse this time than they've ever seen it, you know. Some of that's just a learning curve, you know. The coalition has changed, trying to find their ground, and so we'll go forward. And you know, we're going to keep. There's common ground on all issues somewhere, so we just keep working with them, you know, and try to make things work and get us moving forward the right direction. Get our process a little bit more functional is really what we need to do, and quit playing the partisan politics so much.
You've mentioned that a couple of times, and in just the last couple of minutes to kind of wrap up talking about the process, what are some things that you would like to see change, or what are some things that you think would help move things along so that, again, regardless of how an issue shakes out, whether you agree with it or not agree with it, at least a decision was made and something got done?
You know, I'd like to see when we take an issue to the floor, I'd like to see us have a true floor debate. I don't want to see a chit sheet showing that you got support for this issue before it's been debated amongst all 40 members. You know, that is not a good discussion to have when you go behind closed doors and agree to vote for or against something before it gets to the floor and have all members participate in that discussion. That is the true process right there, and vote it up or down on its merits. At that point, let the public hear the genuine debate, not the theatrical floor show that you see sometimes on the House floor. I don't like that. That's not doing the people's business, you know. So that's what I'd like to see changed. I'd like to see the true debates on the floor. If we're in Juneau, if we're going to take it to the floor, let's debate it. I don't care if it takes all day, all night, you know. That's the type of process. I think the public is old that, you know. To really hear the discussion. If nothing else, it informs them a lot more about what the discussion is all about. So
Yep, and as you mentioned earlier, gets them involved, gets folks with a little skin in the game, as
absolutely,
it were.
Absolutely, absolutely. It gives them better understanding of what we're trying to comprehend down there.
So. Yeah. Very good. Well, Representative Canapa, I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us this morning. It's been a great conversation. Thanks for coming out.
You bet. Thank you.
All right, and thank you all for tuning in. This is KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. You've been listening to the Kenai Conversation. We'll have this episode posted on our website, kdll.org, a little bit later today. Until then, though, have a great morning.